I want to start off this lesson asking, how many of you have ever had any doubts about God? But I decided not to ask that question because I don't want to tempt anyone to lie. The truth of the matter is we've all had doubts. The question is not whether we have doubts or not, but how to deal with those doubts. So I want to look tonight at the lesson and how we can battle our doubts. And the first point I have to look at is the fact that good men in the Bible had their doubts. And you can think of a list. I'm going to give a few, and you probably can think of more than I'm going to be giving. Who are some good men in the Bible who had doubts? Think first of Peter. And on several occasions, but the one that comes most to mind is when Jesus begins walking on the water towards him. What an amazing thing to see. And Peter, at first, has faith. I want to walk to you on the water. Jesus says, come on. And of course, as he looks at the waves around about him, he begins to have his doubts. And he begins to sink beneath the waves. Here's a man who had seen miracles with his own eyes, and when it came to his own safety, he did not want to put himself in the hands of the Lord. Abraham. Now, when do you think Abraham had his doubts? Several occasions you might could point out, but I'm thinking most of all was when he said, Sarah, my wife, is my sister. A half-truth. And he didn't just do it once. He did it twice. And it's like it ran in the family because later on his son did the whole thing. Did the exact same thing. Other examples that come to mind. The prophets. You can read the prophets struggling with their own doubts all through what they wrote. One that comes to my mind, of course, is Habakkuk. There in the chapter 1, he tells Jehovah about all the injustice he sees. It's horrible. Well, God says, I'm going to take care of that. I'm going to send the Babylonians to punish all the evildoers. And you can almost see Habakkuk throwing up his hands. The Babylonians, they're a lot worse than we are. And so, through his book, he struggles with his doubts and the coming destruction of his people. And yet, towards the end, he begins to resolve them by simply placing himself in the hands of the Lord. Other examples, the apostles during the storm. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Oh, you of little faith. How often that phrase, you of little faith, all through the New Testament teaching. And of course, the most famous doubter of all, Thomas. Even after all of his companions came to him saying, we've seen Jesus raised from the dead. You remember his words, don't you? Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. But what's my point? It's nothing new to have doubts. We don't lose our salvation because we have doubts in and of themselves. We lose our salvation because we don't take the spiritual medicine that God gives us for those doubts. Let's ask ourselves this question. Why do we doubt? I can think of several reasons why doubts seem to creep into our mind. In the first place, we're all programmed to think physically. The small child has to adapt to the physical world. They have to learn how to eat. Sometimes they're not very good. They get their spaghetti all over their face. They have to learn to put on their clothes, and the arms go this way and not that way, and button is very tough sometimes. I think sometimes even tough for me. These are physical things. And sometimes the little children begin to think of something imaginary and they begin to see ghosts in their room and they're frightened. What do we tell them? No, there's no such thing as ghosts. Because we know they have to deal with the physical world. And yet sometimes it comes to our minds that the spiritual world is something kind of difficult for us to grasp, especially as we become older. Why do we doubt? I think sometimes we think of some tough text in the Bible that cause us to scratch our heads. In the Old Testament, God commanded the complete destruction of certain nations, Canaanites. And it appears in some texts that even women and children are mentioned along with those who are going to be slaughtered. Why? I have a whole lesson on this. I'm not going to get into that now. But there are some odd laws there in the Old Testament as well. Why did God command things like the bitter waters to determine if a woman was an adulteress or not? That's a head-scratcher, isn't it? And why? How can we apply that today? And even in the New Testament, we have some tough texts. I saw something written by Elie Wiesel, and you may have heard of him. He's a hero from the Holocaust in the Second World War. And he talked about reading the Bible, and of course he's looking at it from a Jewish perspective. He says that when he reads the Old Testament, you know, he reads the history of the children of Israel, and then he comes to the New Testament and demons. Demons here, demons there, demons being thrown out. And you could tell as he was talking about it that he was mentioning something that gave him doubt, in particular about the New Testament. I don't understand everything there is to understand about demon possession or how they were there. I can't explain it to you. And yet, sometimes when we can't explain these things, we begin to have doubts. And what about Ananias and Sapphira? Slaughtered because of their lie. Why did God do that? So we scratch our head. There are a group of what we call new atheists who take some of these tougher texts and really hammer them in and try to produce as much doubt as they can. So, sometimes those things produce doubts. Why do we doubt? We can't comprehend the greatness of God. And it doesn't take very long to get into the mind-blowing mode here, does it? How is it that God has always existed? Now, you know, we just can't explain it. We just accept it, but we can't explain it. And yet sometimes we're a little bit arrogant and think that if we can't explain it, it just couldn't be. How did He create the universe just with His Word? And what about the extensiveness of the universe? And our mind gets boggled real quickly when we start talking about even our own galaxy, the Milky Way, and that's just one of billions. And the what? It's hard for us to comprehend. Sometimes we doubt because we don't think that God is fair. Children suffer from hunger. Children starve to death. Good people die painful deaths with cancer. How could a good and a just God permit this? How could there be such a thing as hell, a place of eternal punishment for people? Well, we scratch our heads. We don't understand it completely. But here comes the doubts. Maybe I've mentioned some things that have given you doubts in the past, or maybe some other things that I haven't mentioned that give you doubts. Not wrong to have them, but here's the most important question. How do we fight those doubts? Let's talk about several things that will help us. Some spiritual medicine will get us on our way. First of all, we must learn to seek the answers when they are available. There was a young man who was baptized in New Jersey. Baptized in summer. And then he says, I'm off to the University of Arizona. I don't know why a guy from New Jersey went to the University of Arizona, but anyway. And, okay, but we've got to stay in touch. We've got to maintain contact. Well, the first thing I got back from him, I knew you'd be the happiest one to know. I'm taking a Bible course. I'm taking a course called The Bible as Literature. Oh, no. And, of course, what's the key term in that phrase? The Bible as literature, not as the Word of God. And, of course, if you've ever had a course like that, the key goal of the professor is to produce doubt that we have these different theories explaining how we got the Old Testament and the New Testament. And of course, none of the theories has to do with God's inspiration. I told him, look, I think you have two choices if you want to be a Christian. First of all, don't take the course, or take it and promise that you're going to read some books that I'm going to send you that will give you a lot of answers to these theories that you're going to be hearing from your professor. But he chose B. I think I sent him a couple of books. I think I sent him evidence that demands a verdict, volume 2. And he started looking at the book, and sure enough, just about everything his professor said, there were some answers there to those theories that he was giving. I think he came out of that experience with stronger faith because he saw the shallowness of the accusations, and he saw that for every accusation against the Scriptures, there was an answer. I think we need to realize that for every at least classical argument that's used to attack the Bible, to attack the concept of God, there are brilliant people down through the centuries who've given good answers. We're not talking about anything new. We're not the first ones to ever have to battle doubts. It's a battle that's gone on for millennia. And there have been good answers. I'm so glad for those brilliant people who have given some of those answers. But we have to seek them. You know, I don't sympathize very much with people who talk about all their doubts and yet they do not seek answers. I'm thinking of a young person right now who went to the law of Moses and began mentioning some of those things that I mentioned earlier, the points earlier. I don't understand why God seemed to be against women in the law of Moses. Here, men can divorce women. Women cannot divorce men. I just don't think that's fair. I found some excellent material on that. I'll throw out a name if you ever want to look at it. Though I don't agree 100%, but some of the overall points he makes are excellent. It's called, Is God a Moral Monster? By a man named Copan. Well, I sent that book to her. I don't think she's ever read it. You know, some people just like to have doubts and talk about their doubts so that they maybe can even come across kind of an intellectual. Look, I have doubts about that. And then when there are answers available, they're not really interested. It's hard for me to respect that. On the other hand, I do sympathize with those who say, I've got doubts. And yet they redouble their efforts to read the Scriptures. They redouble their efforts to talk to others who may have some answers. And usually, with that type of an approach, what happens? Faith in the long run is strengthened. Here again, it's not sinful to have doubts. It's sinful not to apply the remedy to those doubts. And here's one of them, seeking answers. Well, here's something else. We need to take context into consideration when dealing with difficult texts. Think of the law of Moses in particular, and I think that's where most of our doubts come from. It was given to a very primitive and violent culture. And the purpose of the law of Moses was to move those primitive and violent people from where they were towards an ability, incrementally, step by step, towards where in Jesus Christ they could return to God's ideals. And don't just take my word for it. That's what the Scriptures teach about the importance of the law of Moses. A couple of verses quickly. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 6. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. Hebrews 8, verse 6. Well, someone might ask, well, why didn't God just give that to the people 1,500 years before Jesus? What was perfect? They weren't ready for it. To get even more detail, you can go to Matthew chapter 19. This is where Jesus makes this point even more explicitly. Here, of course, the great question about divorce. Can there be divorce for any reason? Jesus answers in verses 4 through 6. Go back to the beginning. God made male and female one. They're one flesh. What God has joined together, let man not put asunder. But his opponents weren't going to give up easily. And verse 7 of Matthew 19, well, what about the law of Moses? The law of Moses gave, made arrangements for a law, for a certificate of divorce to be given. Here is verse 8, and I think this is a key text to understand the law of Moses and even those difficult passages in the law of Moses. He, Jesus, said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. Why those primitive laws about divorce in the law of Moses? Why not the perfect law back from Genesis 2 as God intended from the beginning? Hardness of heart. Primitive people. Backward people. People simply unable to accept his ideals. We've got to take that into consideration when dealing with these difficult texts. The law of Moses was never intended to reflect God's ideal. It was, as it were, a stopgap to take a primitive, violent culture step by step towards the ideal in Jesus Christ. Here's an illustration. I don't know if this is a good one or not. There are elements in this illustration that could be true, and there are elements I'm just adding to make to illustrate. Think of a primitive culture that we've heard of today, the primitive tribes on the island of New Guinea. Just in the last, there's civilization is coming in slowly into that part of the world. When Westerners first began to go into the interior of New Guinea, the primitive tribes there, if they ever had any difficulty or any problems, they would just have a war and kill each other. Wipe each other out. That was the way to deal with conflict. Suppose you're going in there as a teacher of the gospel. You're going to try to civilize them. How do you deal with disputes? You say, no, hold on. Don't kill each other. Have you ever heard of the Magna Carta? Have you ever... Let's talk about English judicial system. Let's talk about judge. And let's talk about the presumption of innocence. And maybe we could have jury. Is that going to work with such primitive people? That is not going to work. They can look at you as if you're nuts. They're not ready to deal with that type of thing. So, and this is where it's getting into a little bit of fiction. You might say, don't kill each other. Just pick out your best wrestler. The biggest guy, you pick out your best wrestler. Go at it, and whoever wins the wrestling match, that's who wins the dispute. Yeah, you might could get by with that. A lot better with Englishmen with wigs and white wigs and so forth for a judge. What would that be? Would that be an ideal way to resolve disputes? No, it would not be an ideal way, but it would be better than just killing each other. And perhaps after a period of resolving matters through or wrestling matches, you could start to bring in a primitive type of judicial system. I don't know if that illustration helps or not. But the point is that when people are so backwards, so far behind, you have to take them where they are and work towards the ideal. Keep that in mind when reading the law of Moses and some of those difficult to understand texts. Something else we can do to fight doubts. Concentrate on what we can understand. There's so much we can't, but there are some things we can that help us to believe. That's what we need to take a hold of. Let me give you a quick illustration. I mentioned earlier that my wife has lupus, which is this kind of a disease where your body's autoimmune system starts to attack even good parts of the body, so there's inflammation, and if it gets advanced, even your internal organs. She has one of the best rheumatologists evidently in the world. Dr. Harry Spira is his name. We got a hold of him. They're on Park Avenue in New York. He likes our southern accent, so he treats us real well. And evidently a pioneer in a lot of the research on lupus. Well, he's given her a cocktail of different kinds of medications that seem to work very well. And I asked him, which do you think is working the best? And he mentioned this drug here. It's called Plaquenil. It's an anti-malarial drug. How does that work? I asked him. Well, he said, don't really know for sure. It just seems like it works. Well, do you have to understand exactly how it works to be willing to take that drug? Well, we'll take it, even though we don't understand, because it's helping. You see the principle? Do we say, well, I don't understand everything about how Plaquenil works, I'm not going to take it? No, then you would be missing out on a lot of good things. You take it, even though you'd understand exactly how it works. And that's the way it is with so many other things. There's so many things that we do not know exactly, but we do know that it does happen that way. I mentioned RNA and DNA all through these messages, and mention a little more in just a second here. We don't know how that works. It's a mystery in many ways. Now we're starting to get a little hold on some of the fringes, but we know it. That affects our genetic makeup in ways that we don't understand. Well, what are some things that we can understand? Well, I just mentioned my old RNA and DNA. Life is simply too complex to be the result of chemical reactions or mutations. This is, of course, the most difficult area where our macroevolutionists are going to have problems. This cell of each living being is built with many different things, including RNA and DNA, so complex. And this is convincing some people that there has to be a designer. We can put our, even if you're not a brilliant rocket scientist, you can understand that. Here's just a simple argument that I've never heard a good answer to, and that is that design demands a designer. You see the watch. Now you may have even noticed my nerd watch. I love my nerd watch. It's about $20 at Walmart. And the thing I like about it is to set my alarm. I just go click, click, and the alarm is set. I don't have to punch this button 3 times and that one 4, and it's blinking at me. So that's why I like my nerd watch. Well, even this cheap Walmart Casio watch. Hope there's no sales representatives from Casio here. Probably has probably 100. There may be 700 little pieces, little buttons and so forth. If I took them all apart, I had several hundred little pieces and screws and buttons here in my hand, tossed them up in the air, how many times would I have to do that before we'd all fall down, all put together, saying 10, 26, and 45 seconds. I did change my clock last night. Sunday, and now 53 seconds. How many times would I have to do that? Of course, you know, that's something that's not going to happen. There's too much design involved here. There's too much complexity. Random chance cannot do it. If there's no God, that has to explain why we're here. Random chance. Now you can try to work out a little bit of design here and a little bit of design there, but enough design to put together our RNA and our DNA? No, sir. Now, the best thing I've seen is knowing that, oh, that's just a bunch of, dismissed. But I've never seen a good answer to that. Here's something else we can understand. A man named Jesus changed the history of the world. Without swords, without armies, without political power. Just a humble carpenter. Now we've had influences from other religions throughout the history of the world, and I guess what comes to your mind most is Islam. It spread throughout the Middle East. How? Military force, conquering. How did Christianity spread? A message of love from a carpenter? A few decades after his death, his teaching was changing forever Western world and Western culture. Now, how could that have happened if there weren't a divine hand in that? These are some things we can put our finger on. We can't understand these things. Hundreds of witnesses saw him alive after his death. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. The Apostle Paul is dealing with some Corinthians who 25 or 30 years after the death and resurrection of Christ are already having doubts, and we can understand it. A dead man back to life? And in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it's almost as if Paul is saying, and I'm modernizing, of course, his approach, wait a minute. Are you denying the resurrection of Christ? If you're going to deny that, just stop being a Christian. Stop claiming you're following Him. Let's just go all the way back to the beginning. And there in the first verses of 1 Corinthians 15, we have it. Jesus Christ died. He rose from the dead. How do we know He rose from the dead? He appeared to witnesses. And He calls them forth. In verse 5, Cephas, then the 12. Verse 6, then He appeared to more than 500 brothers at once, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. And He goes on and talks about James, and He goes on and talks about Himself. Over 500 people saw Jesus alive after His death. Well, I don't know about it. And at the time Paul wrote, it's almost as if he's giving a bit of a challenge here. If you don't believe it, most of them are still alive. It might be worth your while and go and speak with some of those witnesses. The fact that he could speak so certainly about the testimony just of those people who saw our Lord after His death and resurrection lets us know that something did happen. And that explains why that message just exploded on the Roman Empire in the first and second centuries. They weren't all dummies and idiots. They looked and saw the testimony. They analyzed it. They were closer to it than we are. We have it written here in the Scriptures. And though many, many were changed, leaving their families, leaving their culture, leaving the dominant religion, everything was working against Christianity. It was as far as the Romans were concerned, it was a bunch of ignorant nobodies from a backwoods area that had absolutely no influence, and yet the message just kept on overpowering. Why? It wasn't its source, backwoods Judea. It was the message itself. I say the human source, I should ask. It wasn't the human source. It was the message, because the message, the real source, was God. You know, there's a lot of things I don't understand about harmonizing the Gospels. How do you harmonize this and how do you harmonize that? I can give you some pretty good explanations that I'm not 100% sure of, but I know this. I know this. Hundreds of witnesses saw Him alive after His death. And that can help us to believe. Well, let's keep on talking about how to fight our doubts. What are some things we can understand? No man ever spoke as this man. And that's John 7:46. Don't pay any attention to the reference on the screen there. How could just a regular Jewish carpenter speak words that even today, although we're getting away from them, have so greatly affected our culture for the good, if God were not with him? You know, when we face difficult questions we can't understand, we just need to realize and focus on those things that we do understand. Here's something that's hit me a little bit lately, although I've always preached from this. John chapter 9. This is the story of Jesus healing the lame man. Now, in John 9, as you read through, here's a man born blind from birth. Here are two facts that we can get from this chapter. First fact, Jesus healed a man born blind. His neighbors knew him, born blind. His parents recognized that this is our son who was born blind. After seeing Jesus, he can see. And we can imagine how marvelous that must have been. But here's another fact from John chapter 9. He did it on the Sabbath day. And so those are the two facts. Now, which of those two facts most concerned the Jewish leaders who came upon the scene? Did they even care about the first fact? That Jesus healed a man born blind? That didn't bother them in the least. But he did it on the Sabbath, and we have some regulations and rules. We think he did wrong. How can he do that on the Sabbath? What are they doing? I like this expression. They're just overlooking the elephant in the room. You mean you can't even focus on the fact that this man was born blind and healed because you're so hung up about your Sabbath day interpretations? Isn't that the way we are sometimes? Well, I just don't know. There you have God told the Israelites to destroy all the Amalekites, all of them. I just don't understand that. What about the 500 people who saw Jesus alive after his death? You're just overlooking that. Does that not mean anything to you? Well, how do you harmonize that Matthew did not even mention the appearances of Jesus in Judea, only those in Galilee? Just explain that for me. Well, you explain to me how 500 people saw him alive after he was dead. Oh, we're all so concerned with picking out our little things and our little doubt causers. Then we overlook the elephant in the room. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense and did not make any sense in John chapter 9. And it doesn't make any sense today. So let's not be like those people. A few more facts that we can understand. Well, I meant to... Oh, let's just make this point before we go. The blind man didn't make that mistake. He answered and said, when they said, he did this on the Sabbath. And the blind man says, whether he's a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. That's the way we need to be. Don't know about all of this, but I do know this. And that's how we can deal with our doubts and strengthen our faith. How to fight? Accept that our minds are finite. There's much that we will never grasp. And if we think that if we can't grasp something, it cannot exist, then we're being very arrogant and very foolish at the same time. Here's a little illustration. When my girls were little, we bought them a fish tank. We said, we bought it for them, but I kind of wanted it too. You know, dads can do that. Well, we put little angel fish and zebras in there and a blue gourami. And so here are all the fish swimming around in their fish tank. And as I'm sitting there reading a little bit, I look over at the fish tank and it's starting to get a little philosophical. You know, this is about as deep as my philosophy goes, I think. Just what do those fish know? What do those fish understand about what's going on in life? Well, I know that fish understand that when I go over there to the fish tank and raise the lid, there might be some food on the top because you see them kind of going to the top. They're hoping there's going to be some food there. They know that. They know that. The fish understand Republican presidential politics. I don't understand it. Does that mean that Republican presidential politics don't exist? They exist. I think all of you that live up in New Hampshire know that it exists. And it's all the... I'm so sorry for you having to go through what you're going through. Do fish understand what's going on in a six-cylinder automobile? They don't have any idea. I don't have any idea. Sometimes I don't think my mechanic has any idea. These things are out of the sphere of fish. They're just not designed to understand all of that. Now, if you could imagine such a thing as if one fish saying to another, you know, there just couldn't be such a thing as a six-cylinder auto. That would be foolish. It's even beyond comprehension. Even mentioning it is absurd. Isn't it absurd for us as fish to think we can understand all these deep things of God, and if somehow or another there's something we can't grasp, it just couldn't be. We just don't accept that. It's beyond us. That's foolish. We have to go back and look at what we do understand. We can understand enough to believe and just accept the fact that our minds are finite. How to fight our doubts? More Bible reading. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. The more you read the Scriptures, the more you see the finger of God in the Scriptures. And the more you learn to put in the right category those difficult things that sometimes cause doubts. When we have doubts, we need to ask for God's help. Here in Mark chapter 9, Jesus came down with Peter, James, and John from the Mountain of Transfiguration. He saw the rest of his apostles having all kinds of difficulty helping a demon-possessed young boy whose father was desperate. Well, Jesus came into the situation, shook his head, you can almost imagine it, at what was going on, and began to address himself to the Father. Everything is possible for him who believes. The response of the Father is something that we need to have in mind today. Well, how did the Father respond? I think I've got it. No, I don't. Hey, here it is right here if you've got good eyes. Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my disbelief. I believe. Help my unbelief." We're often like him. Yes, we believe, but is it a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as faith is concerned? Not if we're human beings. So, if we're followers of Christ, though we believe, we realize we disbelieve sometimes. We need to grow in our faith. This should be a part of our prayer, shouldn't it? Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. And finally, consider the consequences of rejecting God. If there is no God, we are simply the products of a chemical reaction and genetic accidents. There's no standard of right and wrong. You don't know where you're from. You don't know where you're going. Life has no meaning. Our life and the lives of others are nothing more, as Bertrand Russell said, and this is quoted all over the place, the accidental placement of atoms, ATOMS. Is there something that rebels against that? A good question is, where did that come from? Is there an instinct within us that seeks something deeper in life than that? I believe there is, and I believe God put that instinct there. But the bottom line is, when man rejects God, the further and further he gets away from him, the more disastrous things can become. Here's some guys on some stamps that you may know of. There's Hitler, Mao, Stalin. Stalin, a theology student before rejecting God. The millions and millions of people killed by these butchers. I think Jerry L. asked me today, which one was the worst? It's hard to say. If you look at percentage of population killed, I guess old Pol Pot in Cambodia would be up there with just monsters. If we're just animals, if that's all there is to us, then we kill others, others kill us. It's a dog-eat-dog world. There's something in us that rejects that, and we need to consider where that something comes from. That can help us fight our doubts. Close with a little illustration. Suppose that 4,000 years from now, if God allows the earth to exist that long, some archaeologist is digging up and he just continually comes over something like this. And the archaeologist steps back and steps, what is this? It's plastic, you know, it doesn't degrade, so it's still there. And what are we going to do about it? He says, well, really, if you just have this, there's no this electrical outlet. There's no meaning to it, no purpose. And yet, obviously, it has some design of some kind there. Somebody put it there with a design. What is the meaning of that? And he says, I just don't know. It's the big mystery what that means. But he keeps on digging, and he comes up with something like that. Oh, there we go. That's what this is for. There's something that goes into that. The existence of this pretty much assumes the existence of that plug. See the point? Man without God But there's got to be something there. There's got to be some meaning, got to be some purpose. Obviously, there's design here. What is there? Then we hear of God. That's it. That's what we need plugged in. That's our only hope. Without God, man makes no sense. So what do we do? We seek Him. We seek Him. You know the words of Paul in Acts 17 to the people there of the Areopagus. He told them, these Gentile Greek philosophers, He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward Him and find Him, yet He is actually not far from each one of us. We seek God through His Word. If you want to seek God, that's the way to seek Him. Not through your feelings, not through your intuition, through His Word. If you'd like help in seeking Him through His Word, let us take the book of Luke and read through it with you. Or let us take the book of Acts and read through it. The book of John. Or study the Word in other ways. You don't have to have a shallow, meaningless life. You can have purpose. You can know God. You can have the medicine to bout you with which you can battle your doubts. Let us know after service today, and we'll do whatever we can to help you. Thanks for your good attention, and we'll end this class now and have a recess until the services. Thank you.